Hello and welcome to Season 3, Episode 13 of Logicast, the AWS News podcast brought to you by Logicarta. I'm Carl Robinson, CEO and co-founder of Logicarta, and I'm joined today, as always, by my colleague, John Goodall, Lead Cloud Engineer at Logicarta. How are you doing today, John?
I'm impressed. You're getting the AI transcription tags in there now. This is good. This is good.
Prompt engineering built into the script, even though there is no script. We can't say that. We've mentioned AI before we've even got out of the introductions. So I think that's a first.
I'm kind of warming to it now because it's doing stuff for us rather than being this ethereal thing that just we have to talk about every so often. So I'm warming
Fair
to
enough.
It.
Fair enough. And I'm hoping that we don't regret having it in episode 13. I think we've had episode 13s before and nothing went horribly wrong. But of course, being from the Isle of Man, I am superstitious by nature. So fingers crossed all goes well. Anyway, we're also joined today by a very special guest, Vijaya Gopal, who is a fellow AWS community builder. So how are you doing today, Vijaya?
Yeah, hi. I'm good. Thank you. Great. How are you?
Very well, thanks. Apart from the cold, I'm trying not to try and breathe through my nose because it isn't working very well at the moment, and I'm hoping that's not coming through too much on the microphone. But Vijaya, tell us a little bit about yourself. You're an AWS community builder, but what do you do for a living, and what do you do for the community, that kind of thing?
Right. So basically, I started with IT experience, around 18 plus years of IT experience, and then around 8 years or so now into AWS Cloud. I started my AWS Cloud journey, and since then, I have been working continuously and providing cloud solutions as part of the organizations I work with. And also, apart from that, the same time I joined AWS user groups. By then, that was the only forum that gave a lot of information and platform for you to share and also learn from each other. So that is how I entered into it and slowly became a community builder as well. So I do conferences, AWS Cloud conferences. I've been to summits and also to reInvent. So still continue to do that because it's highly beneficial and also innovative. So we keep learning and we're also up to date. So that's about me.
Cool. Which category are you in the Community Builder Program?
Security and Identity.
Oh, I think that might be a first. If we had a Security and Identity Builder Program?
Yes, we have. We have. It's going to really bug me, but we have had someone on before who then promptly went to Reinforce like the week after he was on this. I'll remember who he was in a bit.
We haven't had many though, so we haven't had many. It's usually serverless for some reason. I think there's more serverless than anything else. I don't actually know the stats, so I'm saying that without actually knowing the numbers behind it, but that's cool. And whereabouts in the world are you?
I live in Toronto, Canada.
Do you like it there?
Yeah, awesome. Initially, you have to settle down with the cloud. I mean, cold and winters and also summers, it's difficult here. But after an year or so, now I'm good.
Yeah, you have some pretty major extremes of temperature there.
Right.
Yeah. How is it right now? Is the spring kicked in yet?
Yeah, it's an early spring here, but it's good. It's not too cold or too warm. It's good.
Good, good.
Okay. I'm going to have to check a map, but I'm pretty sure Toronto is further south than the UK. I'm going to have to check a map, though.
Yeah, not sure. Actually.
There's not a lot in it.
Yeah. We're not here to give a global seasonal weather forecast. Regular listeners to the podcast will know that we are here to talk about AWS news. Every week, I collate a list of AWS news, which I share via my weekly AWS News Roundup newsletter. And then John and I pick a subset of the articles from the newsletter that we'd like to talk about with our guests. So we do, of course, have such a selection of articles this week. And the first one is a new feature announcement from AWS. About how Amazon DynamoDB now supports AWS Private Link. So, John, I was going to come to you, but I can see you're coughing.
All right, I'm all right.
You have recovered. Apologies if you are listening to this and not watching it on video, but John did just have his hand over his mouth. John, Amazon DynamoDB supporting Private Link. What are your thoughts on this one?
Odd one. Odd. I'm not sure what the use case is, but I'm sure there is one. Otherwise, they wouldn't have bothered to do it. For the benefits of the listeners, let's do a couple of definitions. So private link is a way of doing private connectivity between VPCs without using things like a VPN, because VPNs are awkward and they're expensive and they're difficult to manage. Private link is managed service, set and forget, job done. Typically, you see it connecting to things like network load balancers so that you can access applications in another VPC. Typically, this is a vendor that you're doing this with. Excuse me. So you can connect to applications in a vendor account securely over the internet without using things like VPNs. Cool. Adding DynamoDB to this is okay, fine. No, it's not earth shattering. It's nice. Means that you can do secure connectivity cross account to DynamoDB without doing things like VPC peering or transit gateway or VPNs. You know, basically all the same sort of, why would you use private link? Because you don't want to use any of these services. You don't want to use a VPN. You don't want to use transit gateway. You don't want to do VPC peering because you don't own the account, perhaps. So, yeah, it's an odd thing that they've sort of gone, let's put DynamoDB in. Like, I'm not sure what the whole list of services are that support the private link supports. I'm not sure offhand. But it's an odd one. Like, I'm struggling with a use case here.
Any thoughts, Vijaya? Obviously, security is your chosen specialist subject. Any thoughts on this one?
Yeah, hands down here, because my exposure and experience with DynamoDB is like very, very nominal. So I have used it for kind of evaluation. So as John said, there is private link that has been announced on DynamoDB, and it is to securely establish connections and to connect with a particular DB from your vendor application or, as he said, from your different AWS accounts. But having this feature is good to know and good to have. But I'm particularly not sure how it is beneficial when compared to using other modes of connectivity, like connecting it through Direct Connect or Internet Gateway or having it VPC pairing. Probably VPC pairing has maximum number of connections allowed, and in such cases, maybe private link comes in a more secure form. And that is my area of understanding, especially about this feature. And it's also about comes along with the pricing that is mentioned here. So whoever is using in terms of connecting with so many external applications, you know, communicating back and forth, this would probably be more useful and secure. It's like more of tightening the security and eliminating load and traffic with other modes of connect. That's what I understand from this feature announcement.
Yeah, so it's a bit cheaper than Transit Gateway. VPC peering has a hard limit of 5 VPCs that can pair with each other, and you can't do transitive routing either. So you can't sort of go, we'll just peer everything into this one, and then they can all kind of talk to each other. Doesn't work like that. I'm struggling with a use case. I am. I'm struggling with a use case. Maybe a platform team that's hosting a centralized table or something. Maybe, but. Nick, I'm struggling. I'm struggling.
You did mention that you weren't sure how many AWS services are actually supported by private link. So I thought I'd look that up while you were talking. And I'm not going to go through them all because it's lots. Access Analyzer to X-Ray and everything in between. And if I read them all out, it will take the entire episode. So many, many services supported by private
link. You should do a song. I mean, you're not Forrest Brazil, so
no, I'm not,
maybe
no.
Not.
I don't have his musical talent, unfortunately. Perhaps I could stretch to singing the song, but not actually playing the keyboard while doing so. But cool. Okay, well, let's move on from DynamoDB supporting private link to our next article for this week. And it's another feature announcement. And this one is the fact that AWS Secrets Manager has announced support for Amazon Redshift serverless data warehouse. So got a bit of serverless in there, John. I'm not sure you'd agree that this is necessarily serverless, but that's a kind of a different debate, really. Tell us a little bit about the Secrets Manager support for Redshift serverless data warehouse.
So I picked this one out because fairly recently SSM got a bit of love in this kind of regard, where it got a bunch of new features and everyone's like, oh, you can just stop using Secrets Manager. And then Secrets Manager gets some attention as well. So it's okay, fine, cool. So what are we doing here? Well, Secrets Manager historically has been able to interface with things like RDS to manage the automatic rotation of your credentials on a schedule. And you could kind of do that yourself anyway, because you could write the Lambda and you could get it to do all the rotations and sort of all the rest of it. But Secrets Manager made that process rather easier for you. It was kind of baked in. You say, this is a database password. It goes to this database and it will just create the secret with all the information that that secret actually needs. Would you like us to manage the rotation? Oh, yes, please. Brilliant. Okay. I think you might still have to write the Lambda. I don't know. You used to. It's not something I tend to do very often because password rotation is not something that I really get involved in. It's a funny one. I argue with security people about it sometimes, but we'll leave that aside. What they've done is they've added an integration for Redshift Serverless. Ha, brilliant. If that's a thing that you use, it's another service that has username password as an access model, one of the access models, and Secrets Manager can now automatically rotate creds for that as well. Great. What's not to like?
Thoughts on this one, Vijay?
Yeah, so this is my personal favorite Secrets Manager because earlier I had extensively used RDS, AWS RDS services, and for integrating, I have established Secrets, the connectivity through AWS Secrets Manager. As John said, like Systems Manager parameters can be used for storing your different kind of credentials and all that, but if we have to rotate, that is when you come back to AWS Secrets Manager. And yes, in market, there are a lot of tools which will do the password rotation, or you might as well do it using Lambda. But it's a lot of maintenance. Like if you have a feature that is already available, you'll go for that as a tool. But when you already have them available integrated within AWS, and if it's going to work for sure, then it's always good to use those existing services which are well integrated with your other services, which is Redshift Serverless over here. And that is one key service which has gained a lot of momentum when it was announced, Redshift Serverless, being a data warehouse and it's serverless. That was already a good catch. And on top of that, when they introduce Secrets Manager, it's going to be double benefit on using them integrated together. And also the another benefit would be in case if there are connections established already and the applications or the feature is still running or doing some calculations or reporting, the existing connections will not be affected when the password is actually rotated when it is time to rotate. So you don't have to worry about all this when you use Secrets Manager. Rather, when you do this Lambda kind of executions to rotate your password, and you have to take extreme care about your already up and running connections. So by that way, I think this is a good catch. This is a good feature to go with.
Excellent. John, does Redshift Serverless fit your definition of serverless?
Don't know. Don't know enough about it. Don't know enough about it. The bugbear I take, and I'm going to repeat this because, you know, new listeners, is you can't honestly call a service serverless if you have to pay for it to exist. So Aurora Serverless V2 is the prime example. It's not serverless. You cannot scale it to zero. You pay for it to exist because you have a minimum capacity provision. Not serverless. DynamoDB is serverless because whilst you can do capacity provision, you could do on demand, and that's free. Yes, you pay for the data, but you pay for storage. So that's, you know, you're using it. Redshift Serverless, I haven't looked into it enough to know whether it scales to zero or not, but scale to zero for me is the key point.
Well, we'll come back to that in a future episode. But for now, let's move on to the next article for this week, which is yet another AWS announcement that AWS have announced a 7-day window to return savings plans. And I thought this one was quite odd when I included it in the newsletter. I just was kind of imagining lots of people contacting AWS and saying, I bought this savings plan by mistake. Please, can I bring it back? I'm just wondering how this has arisen that people are buying savings plans that they need to return. But I'll come to you first on this one, Vijaya. What are your thoughts on this one? Have you ever bought a savings plan and needed to return it?
No, I do only give recommendations, but we do end up in that kind of situations. This is actually, what do you say, a savior for all of them who just agree for savings plans. I guess I haven't actually made, but there is an alert that can come up and say, or you know, go for a renewal for your savings plan from Cost Explorer. There is an option, I guess, but I'll get back on that, or I'll post in the DevTo platform in the future. But using all Compute Optimizer, teams would decide that they need a savings plan and all that. And finally, when they actually pick up, they might have come up with a different option or solution. And that is when they wanted to take it back, or suddenly the decisions on using the service or this particular EC2 categories changes and they're not able to do that, honor it. And then they want to pull back. So earlier it wasn't possible. Now with this announcement, it's really going to be a cost and effort saving mechanism for many out there. So as you said, it's highly unlikely that people go and buy a savings plan by mistake. That doesn't happen. There are a lot of you know, approvals that goes through, and then
I've seen it. Not by mistake, no. The big example that I tend to go for is one of the things that we do as part of our standard landing zone deployment at Logicarta is we block anyone that doesn't have access to the management account from buying savings plans or reserved instances, because developers might very well have legitimate reasons to have access to AWS console, but they don't necessarily know as much as a platform engineer or platform team would do. And you have to prevent them from damaging the platform. So that's kind of the logic there. So I've seen accidental purchases before, and then it's like, ha, you're stuck, which is a bit okay. With our eyes, you could kind of sell them and sort of get some of your money back, but it was a lot of effort. With savings plans, it was just, there you go, done. But I don't see this being an accidental purchase per se, because, I mean, when we do savings plans for customers, and I've bought a dozen or so on other people's behalf, I've done like a few of them now. Something that we do is we take it very seriously. We take a very long view, and we look at the data over the defaults that come out of Compute Optimizer, the 7, 13, 60, and we look at historic patterns and we go, okay, so you're kind of about here, and we'll go down a little bit underneath that just to cover ourselves, and so on and so on and so on. What this does is this solves the two problems. This allows you to be a lot more aggressive with your savings plan purchasing, because you don't have to spend the 3, 4, 5 days working that out. You can just sort of go, that's the number it spat out, I'll pick that. And then in 4 days' time, I will check my utilization rate. And if it's not above 98%, I'll return it. Cool. It's the department store, I've ordered these shoes for choice. It's, you know, you've done it because you wanted to see how it played out. Great. I don't see that happening a lot. But that's certainly something that could happen. What I do see happening more often is some enterprising type, usually an engineer that's got too much access, has bought a 3-year all upfront savings plan, and they've committed for, you know, 3 years at $5 an hour, and that's, I don't know, 100 grand or something. And then they go in there, stand up, and they talk to their manager and go, oh, I've done this brilliant thing, I've saved us a load of money. And he goes, you idiot, you've just cost us 100 grand this month. So quick, unwind that. And then someone from a finance team or someone with a finance head on can go, yeah, we don't have the cash flow for 100 grand this month, but I like where you're going with this. Let's do a no upfront instead. So whilst the discount isn't quite so high, we realize a lot of savings without having a big cash flow implication. So that's kind of where I'm seeing this. It's yes, okay, if you've got your organization, your AWS organization, to be clear, set up such that only key people can do this, only people that know what they're doing can do this, and so on, it kind of saves you a lot of aggravation. But in smaller businesses where you've got a DevOps guy who might not talk to the finance guy, the one finance guy, every day, then it's like, do you have the cash flow for this? I don't know, I could do it. Like, I've been in that scenario before. I have, where I was the one DevOps guy. But fortunately, I sat 4 meters away from the finance bloke, so I wandered over and said, oi, can I do this? No. But it'll save us 40% on the bill. Don't care, we can't afford it. Right, cool, okay, I'll do it now up front. But, it, you know, had that conversation not been available, then it's this sort of thing is then quite helpful.
Right, so From the security and identity perspective, so I would like to add a point here. So one is when the organizations, the volume of users and exposure is less, then we would establish a permission boundary using IAM permission boundaries so that we set users only to use certain kind of services according to their role and designation. So you go for developers, DevOps engineer, cloud developer, so accordingly. And when you have a control tower kind of setup and you deal with a lot of multiple accounts and with different and varieties of sandboxes and domains classified AWS accounts, we might go for service control policies, which would basically establish a proper boundary at the account level. Yeah. So this would be a good mechanism to start with so that we are restricting all of them using left and right, all the services, and causing problems here. They might not know, they might just think that I have created, but they'll not know how it will affect the billing and the budget as well. So
You're not wrong. You're absolutely not wrong. But we've said this a few times. You don't know what you don't know. And one of the great democratizing features of the cloud is anyone can get going with a credit card. But because anyone can get going with a credit card, anyone can get an enormous bill on their credit card without really knowing what they were doing. So anything that allows you to unwind a billing shock, I'm all for it.
Yeah, one would hope that people are not just buying a savings plan by mistake when they didn't want to buy a savings plan. Perhaps they've just bought the wrong one and it doesn't exactly meet their needs, and they need to return it and buy one that is a more appropriate fit. But still, nonetheless, hopefully this money-saving mechanism is going to stop people from making the wrong decisions in future. So let's move along to our next article for this week, which is an article on dev.2 by Ran Eisenberg, who is a guest on the podcast a few weeks ago, two, 3 weeks ago, maybe. Ran is an AWS hero, and he's written an article about Lambda Cold Start. So I think we've spoken about Lambda Cold Start on the podcast before, but he is posing the question, and of course, answering it with his own opinions in this article, is AWS Lambda Cold Start still an issue? So I'm sure this is something that you have got a lot to say on, John. Is it still an issue?
I mean, I agree with Ran. I mean, I saw that he'd written it and immediately went, okay, we're having that one, because his stuff's really good. We've had him on. He's great. Give him more airtime. Brilliant. So I largely agree with him. It's yes, but not always. So there's a definition in there, and I'm not going to read it verbatim because it's like four lines and my voice won't cope. But the short version is, what's a cold start? Well, a cold start is when you first deploy a Lambda and it's not been run yet, or hasn't been run for a while. It's not actually sitting anywhere other than in some sort of ethereal place that AWS control, probably an S3 bucket. And when it gets called, it gets pulled and it gets executed. Cool. Why is that a problem? Well, if it hasn't been executed recently and they hang around for about 10 minutes, it can take multiple seconds for them to kind of get going and then answer that first request. And I've seen this, you know, personally, where a cold start might be 3 seconds and then a warm start is 300 milliseconds. It's demonstrably different. There's been a number of things saying, though, is this a problem? Well, yeah, okay, fine. Build your application in such a way that it can tolerate that. That's one. Use some of these newer tools that come out. And Rand talks about, using a more up-to-date runtime like Go or Rust or LLRT, which we've spoken about on the pod before, that has a much, much shorter runtime invocation. So it just sort of comes up. You don't have this, you know, I've got to provision the JDK or the JRE environment, which takes 5 seconds to do. It's because you're not writing in Java, you're writing something sensible. Cool. You can do things like provision concurrency. Great. Reserve concurrency. Nah, that's less helpful. And then, as I say, you kind of make your application tolerant to these sorts of things. So if it's like an async workflow, if it takes 3 seconds or half a second to get going, it kind of doesn't matter because it'll get done eventually. You know, back-end processing, background processing. Traffic patterns, take account of them. Provision concurrency ahead of time so that you know when it's going to happen, and then you can build the current concurrency up. And you've seen a few cases where someone will arbitrarily fire a request at their endpoint every 10 minutes just to keep it hot so that the response time is really lightning fast, even for something that gets requested once every 20 minutes, which is like, maybe you should be using something else. But scale to zero, it's a good example for that, but you can't tolerate the latency. Yeah, tricky. An interesting one that Rand's put in here that's a real problem is chained cold starts. And that's nasty. That's nasty. Because if you've got, say, a step function that's calling half a dozen lambdas, and it gets called once every half an hour, every single one of those lambdas, every single time, is going to cold start. All of a sudden, you've gone from your six lambdas executing in sub 1 second to them taking 10. Oh, what's that slow? Oh, that's painful. Chain cold starts. But yeah, it's. I largely agree with him. I largely agree with his outputs. You know, make sure you tune your lambdas properly. Make sure you architect for it. Use something like snap start, which is a thing we spoke about in the pod a little while ago, which is a way of improving cold starts for things like Java. Don't use Java. Use Rust. Use LLT. LLRT. Use something else. And honestly, for Rust content as well, he says this, follow another one of our former guests, Ben Pyle. So, yeah, mm-hmm. It's... I mean, I could talk about this for ages, but my throat is giving up, so I'm going to stop. But the short version is it still a problem? Not as much as it used to be, but you still need to be aware of it.
Thoughts on this, Vijaya? Is it something that you've come across in your world?
Yeah, so not about this cold starts. I have been affected extensively, I would say, because the usage for the use cases that I have implemented didn't have tremendous executions or traffic patterns or lots to download. But I would say this article from Ron has extensive coverage of where the problem starts and until the solution, depending on, he has given a couple of use cases there. For example, there is an architecture diagram, and one of the use cases is about in case you are using it for authentication and authorization, this is not, then there is going to be a lot of login and log off kind of things, which would actually cause this cold starts major issues. So any service or any implementation is actually right or wrong depending on the use cases or the requirement they work for. That is my opinion. So what's good here might not be good in your use case. So with the examples, what he has given, the way he's narrated, and also he has ended up with the performance considerations, how best we can improve by using the change in the architecture and the platform for using Rust and the other LLRT stuff. So these are the suggestions that has been given. That's excellent. And apart from that, he has covered the performance perspectives as well. One is going for the new architecture, for using or executing Lambda, that's going to give benefit and it's going to give faster execution, which is also providing you an efficient runtime. That is one thing, and also avoiding issues like this on latency perspective as well. So I think it's good coverage, and there are a lot of other cases, use cases to explore in terms of cold storage. As you said, serverless is the key topic where most of them are actually working with and facing a lot of issues in terms of this cold starts, but I haven't faced personally in my use cases, but this is a great advantage in knowing all these aspects and difficulties, like where it starts and how to handle it. So this is well narrated and explained here. Nice article.
Cool, thanks for that. Given what we were discussing about the climate in your part of the world, I was wondering whether Lambda cold starts are worse in Canadian data centers than in perhaps, say, Sao Paulo. But
the irony being, the colder the data center, the faster the Lambda's going to start.
Let's not get into the physics of that, because I'm not sure we have the time. On that note, let's move on to our final article of this week, which is all about a study which has shown, shock horror, that moving from on-premises to the cloud with AWS delivers significant cost savings, according to a report.
By AWS.
The article is by AWS, but the report is not. AWS are just highlighting the contents of this report because does. For every report that says that it's moving to the cloud will save you loads of money, I'm sure that people can put forward another use case where it did not, and people have perhaps moved out of the cloud or never bothered moving there in the first place. But let's focus on the positives, because we are all cloud people and we like the cloud, and we like to think that there are benefits of moving to the cloud, and one of those is cost savings. So I'll come to you first on this one, Vijaya. What are your thoughts on this article?
So it has narrated all the aspects of moving to cloud, say like compute storage, and the other one is just give me a second. So it's about networking as well. So in terms of using Direct Connect and Cloud WAN, personally, I'm not sure what is, I haven't used Cloud WAN. Direct Connect, yes, I understand. And coming to moving to storage, yes, I have experienced myself a huge savings for the customers when you use S3 intelligent tiering. So that's a good one. And also Glacier usage in Glacier retrieval, S3 Glacier retrieval. So that is also highly beneficial for customers who doesn't have to keep the data on and move according to your usage pattern and access patterns. And there is something new that has been launched, which is EFS lifecycle management and EBS SSD storage. EBS I have used extensively, but EFS so file EFS being connected by various applications and being used, but not in this aspect of cost savings we haven't looked into much, but the usage was there, so nothing much on that. The another aspect of this article is that about compute coming to savings plans, which we already discussed as part of the 7-day return back feature of AWS savings plans. And then Graviton processes, yes, that's a huge win. If people are into extensive compute, like not all the customers are using all storage, networking and compute. Sometimes it could be for storage and then get into analytics directly using some data warehouse features or using QuickSight and other features. So you can, the use case must be that you must be using only storage and then a different aspect of AWS services or categories. But either ways, collectively, this will give, and also individually, this is giving cost benefits is what they're saying. From my personal experience, I have seen in terms of storage, yes, this is actually a lot beneficial. And also, I have done a use case on data sync as well. So that as well is highly beneficial in terms of cost and savings. Your views, John?
So, I mean, I picked this one out just because it's talking about Formula One and I like racing cars. I'm a simple man. And more to the point, because I actually had the startings of conversations a number of years ago now, Carl, you're safe, about doing DevOps stuff for Formula One, which is like, that's going to be really cool. Yeah, it's going to be with this moving data center. You're going to be in there. Okay, that sounds really cool. I've got young kids. damn, I want to go to Monaco for a weekend every year. But that kind of never happened. But yeah, it's just at a more general sort of level. It's, as Carl sort of said in the intro, you can pick a number of articles out reasonably easily because they get a lot of noise that says, oh, the cloud's really expensive. Oh, it's so expensive, blah, 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 blah. So it's good, I think, that every so often people sort of go, that's not true, actually, because people are just quietly getting on and they're not making the noise saying, oh, we saved all this money outside of the vendor conferences. Fine. More specifically, though, this cloud is more expensive view, it can be. And that's very important because, as you sort of said, through the various kind of ways you can save money, if you were to run a data center versus use AWS like it was a data center, everything on 24/7 and no optimization and none of this cool new serverless stuff and kind of all the rest of it, yes, it is going to be more expensive because that's how AWS make their money. There's a markup there. You know, it's about 30% more expensive if you just run it all the time. Fine. Okay. Don't use it like a data center. Use it like the cloud. It's not just someone else's computer, which is an amusing, albeit reductive viewpoint. It's use it like the cloud. Use it properly. Use these tools so that you can reduce your spend and just be a bit intelligent about it.
Right.
Migrate and modernize. Don't just migrate. If you dump all your VMs in the cloud, it's probably going to cost you more. Unless, of course, you're using VMware and Broadcom. I've just changed all the licensing, and that's now probably costing you more as well, which could be driving more and more people to look at the cloud. But that's a different macroeconomic factor. But yeah, as I said in the intro, for every article that says cloud is cheaper, I'm sure somebody can show me one that says it's more expensive. You know, this article does point to some third-party impartial studies showing how the cloud can save you money. And it does point to a couple of case studies. F1 is one, and there was another one as well, I think, wasn't there? What was the other one? Snap as in Snapchat, yep. About how they have also reduced their storage cost by migrating to the AWS cloud. So if you are considering migrating to the AWS cloud to save money, well worth a read of this article and the various studies that it points to. But that is all we have time for this week. So that was season 3, episode 13 of Logicast, and thankfully it was not unlucky for us. We have almost made it to the end. So thank you, John, as always, for your insights. Thank you very much, Vijaya, for joining us from Canada. It's been great to meet you and to have your insights as well.
Right.
We won't be back next week with another episode of Logicast, but we will be back in a couple of weeks once we've returned from leave. It is holiday season, of course, upon us this weekend, but we'll be back in a couple of weeks with another episode of Logicast. Thank you for listening. If you've enjoyed it, tell your friends. You can download Logicast from wherever you download your podcasts. And if you'd like to see what we look like when we're talking to you, we're also available to stream on YouTube. So thank you again. We'll be back next time. Cheers.
Thank you.